Hey, here we are again for episode 65 of Old School Guns. It's really great to be back here. You know, it's been a couple weeks since I've actually done one. Working at home and being in the coronavirus environment, you would think you'd have all of this free time. And actually, late at night, I do have some free time, and I've been doing some hand loading and other things. But, you know, it seems like my days are just as filled and busy as they are when I was, you know, going into the office and working. So anyway, last podcast, I said, hey, this is episode 65, which was, in point of fact, true, because I never count the primer that I never gave an episode number to. The very first thing I did was, hey, this is what the podcast is about. So, in point of fact, this is actually the 66th entry, but this is episode number 65. Last time was the 65th entry into the podcast library, but it was episode number 64. So, there you go. Let's talk about some things. Obviously, a lot of things have been happening the last 2 weeks. A lot of things have been closing down. You know, businesses have been closing down. A lot of things have happened. We've really gone into what I call the Stalag culture, which is, you know, the government has assumed a lot of authority over who we are and what we do and what is permissible and what is not permissible. And I personally do not see this as a very good thing. I mean, when people are being arrested because they're paddleboarding on a lake, even though I guess they're not being arrested because paddleboarding is illegal, but it's because the lake is closed, because people might get there and get on the beaches and not be 6 feet apart or whatever. But people are getting arrested or getting threatened with being arrested for doing things that really have nothing to do with spreading the virus and don't cause that virus to spread. So I really think that we have to take a look at some of these civil liberties issues. I'm all for stopping the virus. I'm all for social distancing and some of the things that have taken place. But, you know, I was out on a walk, and of course you go out on a walk and people are looking at you, you know, everybody's kind of looking at each other like, man, is this guy carrying the disease or not? But one of the things I saw that I did not like was my local PD. There was the usual, they all drive SUVs now. They really don't drive the patrol cars like Andy of Mayberry, you know, he and Barney had the big patrol car. A lot of times they drive these SUVs, and this guy had it open. This police officer had it open, and he was flying a drone around, I assume looking for people who are breaking one of these new rules that we all have to live by. And I thought, if in a little tiny town like I live in, the cops are surveilling people with drones because of this deal, I think we need to step back and take a look at that. I'm just not into the surveillance culture, and I'm not into the Stalag culture. But that's where we are. And the good news, the silver lining of all this is a lot of people are seeing the value of having a personal firearm. Even though crime is down, the pandemic has not created the walking dead or the rioting and looting and all the rest of it, a lot of people are looking, saying, you know what, it's one of the measures of protection I can take for myself and my family is to have a personal firearm. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. Some gun stores, the ones that are allowed to remain open, if you buy a gun, they actually sell the gun and a box of ammo with it. So, you know, you're kind of ready to go. It's not like they're going to, in the past, when there's been a run on guns and ammunition, you go buy a gun and then you can't find ammo for it anywhere. So I guess they've learned from some of the past times this has happened to kind of make that little package deal, and it's a lot more attractive to the buyers. Okay, another thing that's kind of popping up that's, before I get to that, Bernie's done, Bernie quit. I told you, Bernie was a wimp and didn't want it enough. He should have gone after Biden. Biden is vulnerable, was vulnerable, and still is. And Bernie was a wimp and didn't go after it. And he deserved to lose because he didn't have the guts. to get down tough and fight for the nomination. You know, he thought it was just going to be handed to him. I guess maybe he had talked to Hillary after the last time, and she just said, well, you know, if you run once and lose it, the next time you run, they'll just hand it to you. Maybe he actually thought that. But, yeah, he's a goner. I think he's still going to stay in the background because, you know, sleepy Joe Biden, old Pee-wee Biden, could collapse. And when people find out how senile he really is, they may be looking for somebody just to put on the ticket and go, in which case Bernie would be the obvious choice. Oh, a lawsuit over pro-gun t-shirts in school. Here's kind of what I think about that. I'm not a real fan of politicizing schools. And, you know, you see it all the time. And I guess it's asking too much to try to remove that from the schools altogether, because actually they teach civics and talk about elections and things. But pro-gun t-shirts in school, you know, kids can wear whatever they want as long as it's respectful to others. And if you want to wear I'm a 2A supporter, they should be allowed to do that. But a lot of these teachers, the liberal ones, they will only allow the t-shirts that reflect their own agendas and their own beliefs. So I think it's a good thing. In the thing of can you do it and is it wise to do, I would be very careful about what I would allow a school kid to wear to school, just to make sure that, you know, expressing a view is one thing, but going too far can be something else. And there are some t-shirts out there that go too far on everywhere, not just the 2A ones, but everywhere. So I just think that they should be allowed to wear it, but parents should exercise a little bit of judgment and say, yeah, this is appropriate in our view or this is inappropriate. But I think it's a good thing. We need pro-2A kids, and we need kids who aren't afraid to stand up to it and aren't afraid to stand up to the you know, the conventional liberal wisdom that's expressed in at every level of education about how guns are bad and people who have guns are bad and all the rest of it. You know, the gun control agenda doesn't need to be the only one that kids are exposed to. That's for sure. Oh, let me get to my favorite. This is the big one. Of course, everybody's on YouTube now watching these things because a lot of people are at home, you know, and a lot of people are teleworking and you know, there isn't a lot of places to go at night or anything. So there's a couple of feuds going on at these gun channels on YouTube. And I'm talking specifically about Harrell versus Giddings. And just to give you a quick background, there's a guy named Paul Harrell puts out some very good videos. They're tedious and they're somewhat boring, but he's got a, you know, pretty good method on a lot of his stuff and some good information. Some of his things are actually quite bad in my opinion, as far as the logic behind them is flawed, but you know, no product you put out on the internet, a video that you make yourself, is going to be perfect. It's like the old thing of all books have mistakes. You know, no matter how much you edit them, and you can go over them word by word, you're always later on going to find a mistake. And the same thing with these videos. So I don't take any of these things. I take them all with a grain of salt, saying, hell, you know, this could be a good thing, could not. Maybe it's not a good thing. I don't know. But there's a guy named Giddings who put out a video, and Caleb Giddings is a former Coast Guard guy who's kind of doing something with the Air Force. I don't know if he's in it or a trainer. I assume he's probably maybe an Air Force reservist kind of guy who's doing some training with him. He's also a big-time competitor, IPDA, uses a revolver, and he took exception to Harrell's video about how to basically use a revolver for self-defense. And there's a whole lot of... And then Harrell, of course, puts out a rebuttal video that's an hour long, which watching it is terrible. My view on that whole thing is, first of all, I'm always suspicious when there's a feud because it always generates a lot more people viewing and people expressing things. So I'm always suspicious that maybe they're in cahoots. this doesn't really look like that. And in fact, there used to be guys who were in cahoots on these things in the old gun magazines back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. You know, a guy would write something in one magazine, and in that same magazine, another one of the writers would do a rebuttal, and they'd kind of get in this little writing feud. And what it amounted to was, every month, people couldn't wait to get the magazine to see what the other guy said, you know, in response. And it was done to sell magazines. You know, it was done as a marketing tool. This may be the same thing. I don't really think so, but it could be. It could very well be that these two guys actually talked it over and said, hey, you know, I'll take a swipe at you. You can take a swipe at me. And a lot more people will watch our video channels. So the upshot is, you have the classic gamer versus kind of martial artist guy. Harold is more of a, even though he's got a competitive background, and he looks like he was probably what I think he was, and I don't know this, but I think he was a National Guard guy. And it appears to be he was one of those guys who, at least for part of his career, they had guys who were just detailed to be marksmen. And, you know, they would show up at Camp Perry and state championships and go to Camp Perry and represent the National Guard in some of these shooting contests. And, you know, along the way, you get a distinguished rifle badge, you know, if you're good enough and you pick up the points and all that. And he appears to have all those things. So he appears to be one of those guys. Giddings, as I said before, was Coast Guard, which, you know, they do a lot with weapons on depending on where you are and what you're doing, and then in the Air Force, and of course they have a lot of security deals where they're using small arms. So, you know, these two guys really shouldn't be sniping at each other. They really shouldn't. I guess the part that really kind of gets me is Giddings gets on there and he's drinking during the video, which, you know, he's just ridiculous. I pounded on that one in-range Q&A when those guys were all drinking and they had the knuckleheads from the firearms blog and some other IT dude, you know. And it just, I'm not going to sit there and watch a video where people are drinking and making fools out of themselves. It's just not where I go with all that. So these guys are going and they're arguing about kind of back and forth about HKS speed loaders, and Giddings, who's a gamer, and he's a nationally ranked gamer, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he's probably right in a lot of ways. You know, the HKS speed loader is not a great piece of equipment. It's a good but not great piece of equipment. But I will tell you that there's probably maybe millions of them out there. I can remember about 10 years ago, I went into a sporting goods store that did a lot of police trade-ins, and they had, and this is no exaggeration, two 55-gallon drums filled with used HKS speed loaders that they were selling for $1 apiece. You know, they were obviously police trade-ins. Must have been from a fairly large department, because there were probably thousands of these things. And as I remember right, they were, I actually bought a few of them. I got a few of them kicking around. They were for, you know, kind of the K-frame Smith & Wesson, D-frame Colt kind of guns. And yeah, you go in there and buy them. You know, you just pick through this mass that they had of them and buy them for $1 apiece. So they're out there. A lot of those very high speed gamer, you know, speed loaders, those things are out there, but they're expensive. And they're also larger, bulkier. And so, you know, to put out a video where people are using HKS speed loaders is pretty realistic. So I don't know that that's something people should complain about. But to get up out of the weeds, those kind of feuds are unprofessional, and I don't really like it. If you're going to criticize someone, you can criticize the technique or criticize the information, but don't criticize them, you know, personally like that. Accuse accusations of stolen valor and then bringing, you know, booze into it. The whole thing, that's just really bad. Really very, very bad. Now, in order to clarify, I have pounded In-range TV and Forgotten Weapons a little bit. Forgotten Weapons, I think, is actually excellent. You got a guy, some of these guys have to realize what their talents and strengths are and what they bring to the table that's really useful and really good. And what In-range TV brings that's really, really good is you know, the genius of the two-gun matches and the genius of some of the testing they do with ammunition. And that is really good. I think that's genius. I think the two-gun matches are great. Now, they're a game. They're no substitute for combat. But they are genius. Forgotten Weapons is excellent. You got a guy who's got a background in engineering technology, and what he does is explain in very technical terms some of these weapons, most of them being very obscure, or at least, you know, kind of vintage or antique, and kind of showing the design behind them and showing some of the design methodology and materials and how they fit together, work together, and all that. A very, very interesting, and really that's why it's so successful. In range gets off the reservation with me when they bring on some of these guys and they profess to know what the infantryman needs, because none of those guys have been in the service, much less infantrymen, but they don't have any military experience, so they don't know. They don't understand that a lot of equipment is designed, and it may not be the highest speed gamer equipment, but take your gamer rig and go to the National Training Center, the Joint Readiness Training Center, or 29 Palms for a month deployment in the field and see how long it lasts and see how well it works. And the answer is it won't last very well and it won't work very well because it's not designed for the harsh environment that the infantryman lives in, even on peacetime maneuvers. You know, going to the field for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or when we used to do the old reforger to Germany for 6 weeks, you know, that is taxing, and that's why some of that equipment is designed the way it is. There's a reason why there's a lot of protection built into military equipment, like flap holsters. Yeah, they are slower than the gamer open top holsters. They are, but they protect the weapon from the environment and from all the stuff that gets in there. Same thing with magazine pouches. Same thing with a lot of this, the other equipment that they use. It's designed to protect those things hours and hours and hours, and days and days and days, and weeks and weeks and weeks in a very harsh environment that you don't see in the game world. So that's something they really don't take into account. Same thing with, you know, the design of certain rifles. They are designed to survive an unforgiving environment. And whether or not they're the fastest thing going in the game world is something different. It's a completely different use that they were not intended for. So that's why I kind of pound them. Same thing with CNR Arsenal. I mean, the guy, and I assume it's his wife or girlfriend, you know, face it, they're not experts on military anything. They've even said, and I've seen them give their bios, hey, they met in college, they have no military backgrounds, they're just kind of interested. Well, okay, but don't sit there and use the word grunt to describe an infantryman, because to those of us who've actually been grunts, you know, they have no concept of what's going on there, and they have no concept of the rigors of that life and the rigors that life brings to both people and equipment. So they're kind of like people who commentate on a sport who've never played it on any level. And that's why I criticize them. That's one of the reasons I go after them, when I know they're putting out something that's wrong. I mean, your HoloSun site might be great for a match, but I tell you one thing, you put it in the field for 2 weeks and see how long it lasts. My guess is it won't be very long. Okay, so that's about it for the gun culture and the other portions of what we're talking about. It's a different world that we're all of a sudden finding ourselves in. But like I said before, find projects, go ahead and execute them. I'm doing a lot of hand loading, even kind of later at night. I'll just kind of pop down and do some hand loading, and my Dillon machine has cranked out a whole bunch of, you know, practice loads, so that when we get the all clear, I'll be able to you know, go down to the range, and I'll have, you know, a couple cans of ammo that I can use. Okay, so let's go to my favorite part, which is questions and answers. And we got some good ones today. Okay, from our friend Clown Bear. And Clown Bear always asks something very, very interesting. So this is another very interesting question. Why should the younger generation get into revolvers? And you know, I read that and I said, well, hey, it's obvious. And then I realized it's not obvious. I grew up in a generation of revolvers. Revolvers were the deal when I grew up. I mean, 1911s were around, but the serious handgunners all used revolvers, usually Smith & Wesson and then to a lesser degree Colt. So a lot of people growing up now have not had that the benefit of that experience or have seen that. So why would you, in a world where everybody's producing an automatic and everybody's producing, you know, polymer frame, kind of the safety paddle trigger, 9mm, or, you know, there's just more out there than you can keep track of. In that world, why should you go to a revolver? And I would say the first thing I would do to tell a younger person is go back and read Keith, Skelton, Jordan. Read those three guys. Anything you can from those three guys, read it. And I think you'll see the value of the revolver. The revolver is convenient. It's powerful. And it's very accurate. And if you want to be a, I don't want to use the word master handgunner, but if you want to be a proficient handgunner, the accuracy offered by a revolver is really something that you should master. And it's also like, you know, mastering a double action trigger pull. That's another great skill to have also. Because if you can master that, you can master any other trigger pull on anything else, to be very blunt. And I know guys who can shoot at 50 yards double action. I mean, that's easy. They have practiced for years and years and years, and they do it easy. So that's one reason, is there's a historical use for the revolver that is covered by no other gun. It is practical, powerful, it is there. It's also very reliable. Revolvers are keenly reliable because they don't have detachable magazines. Most jams from an automatic usually come from one of two things: ammunition that can't cycle the gun, or B, the magazine is damaged or out of specification some way. And then usually the third one is something the shooter's doing. Well, a revolver will function much, much better. The magazine is essentially the cylinder, so you have one of those, and it's the same. And unless there's something mechanically wrong with it, it's going to work. It's a lot less ammunition sensitive. You can, in a 357 revolver, you can shoot anything from a 38 wad cutter to a full house plus P 357 load, and you know that's quite a bit of versatility there. So they're very versatile. They're not ammo power sensitive the way an automatic is. The other thing that's nice about, here's one of the nice things about a revolver, is there's no spare magazines to buy. So, you know, you buy it and it is what it is. There's no spare magazines. Most revolvers nowadays come with very good grips on them. So it used to be that people put aftermarket grips on them, but now they come with pretty solid grips. They come with pretty nicely contoured and ergonomic grips. So you don't really need to do that. Many of them, I would say most of them at this point, come with good adjustable sights. So you can dial it in, sight it in and shoot it. All of those things are tremendous advantages. The other thing that I would say is, it for certain sports, revolvers are the only deal. Cowboy action shooting, you know, outside of Wild Bunch, revolvers are it. And even in some of the other shooting disciplines, practical shooting disciplines, USPSA, IDPA, there are revolver classes and categories. So, you know, you're really not out of touch by using a revolver. They also have, if you buy obviously a reputable one, they are, you know, very good resale. The other thing about revolvers is that they're a lot easier to hand load for because of the ammunition versatility they have. You can hand load for them. There are a lot of good reasons to go with revolvers, and more than I can probably articulate, but the best thing to do is go read some of the classic stuff. Another guy I keep forgetting about is John Taffin. He's another guy who's kind of in that mold of the old school revolver guy. And when you read that, you really, not only is it enjoyable reading some of these older things, but it's also very informative, and it really kind of motivates you to get into a very, very rewarding and fun aspect of handgunning, which is shooting the revolver. And so I would say that that's the reason I would give a young person the best reason, the best way to convince a young person to get into revolvers is to let them shoot one, because they will probably become hooked when they see, especially if they're used to 9mm, blah, blah, blah. They all of a sudden shooting that 45 caliber revolver or 44 caliber revolver may be something that they find quite entertaining and will get into. Okay, next question. Here it is. My 5.56 hand loads are sticking in my chamber of my AR-15. What is wrong? And I will tell you, what is wrong is two things. And this is something that it's kind of been around for a while, but a lot of people don't let hand load for 5.56 anymore because the ammunition, at least until now, has been cheap and available. But if you hand load 5.56 for an AR, you'll notice that if you don't use a small base die, you will have a problem that a lot of times the rounds will chamber, but if you withdraw a loaded round, it'll stick. And there's not a lot of power with the standard AR charging handle. It doesn't, you know, it's not like a bolt handle that kind of cams and turns up and creates a mechanical advantage. It's just a straight pull back, and you know, you're not getting a lot of power there. So what you have to do is, if you hand load, you have to use a small base die. The small base die will reduce that cartridge case back to something very, very close to original factory specifications. The next thing you have to do is get a 5.56 gauge. It's called a caliber gauge. Dillon sells an excellent one, but you can get other ones from other manufacturers that cost less. You have to get one of those, and you have to master using it, and it's not hard, but it's basically just a round piece of steel with something that looks like a chamber drilled in it, and you put the empty round in there, and if it sticks out the bottom even a little bit, you've got a sizing problem with those cases. You can also have an overall length problem. The other thing to do is, if you're sticking, is to make sure that your brass is not over the overall length, and consult the any loading manual. Consult that. They'll tell you what the maximum length is, and then go some period under that. They'll usually tell you what the trim length is, and but you've got to consult that kind of thing. Make sure that your brass, if you're going to trim it, is at the trim length, and if you're not going to trim it, you're just producing something because you're not trimming the brass, then go ahead and make sure it's well under the overall length. If you do that and size with a small base die, and also make sure that when you seat your bullets, you seat them with you put just a little bit of bell, or have the expand the case mouth slightly so you can drop those bullets in and they don't get off center and pushed to one side or another. That will cause a case to stick in the chamber also. So, but that's a lot more rare. If you would normally see that when you look at the side, and you'll see that one side of the neck is bulged out a little bit by the bullet. If you see that, you got a problem with your neck expansion. But the small base die is the critical piece, and the overall length is another critical piece. If you take care of both of those things, should be good to go. And the sticking will go away, and the rounds will cycle just like factory rounds. Okay, another question, and here's a good one. Why isn't the 357 SIG more popular? It seems like it has a lot of positive attributes. Okay. I don't know too much about 357 SIG. I fired them. It's powerful. It's a good round. I think the main reason is cost. Cost and perception. The ammunition is expensive. And I personally think it's excellent. If I were going to get into a different caliber for self-defense and purely defensive, I would give 357 SIG a very serious consideration. It is significantly more powerful in the right ammunition than 38 Super. It kind of can, in the lighter bullets that it uses, it can exceed 38 Special Plus P and compete with the 357 Magnum. So it's a really good round, and you can get it in guns that hold, 12, 14 cartridges. But it's very expensive ammo, and I think it has fallen victim to the perception that all handgun rounds are basically the same. Therefore, it is just another 9mm round, and it is a lot more expensive. So that's why it has not caught on. Technically, it does everything it's designed to do, and it fills a very good niche. And another small factor on it is it's got increased recoil, which nobody likes these days. People like 9mm level recoil, and anything above that will exclude a lot of the shooting market because they just don't want to deal with that. They don't want to deal with the increased recoil. But the biggest part is expense. 1,000 rounds of it will cost a lot of money, and 9mm is much more cost effective, and people see it as being as effective or nearly as effective. Okay. What is your opinion of DSA FAL rifles? I've heard bad things about them. Well, I only have a limited knowledge of them. The Israeli DSA FAL rifle is excellent, in my opinion. I think it's as good as anything FN put out. It just is. And I know that, it's got a cast receiver, and that's a bad thing, but I don't really care. I can't tell the difference, so I don't really care. Mine's been accurate, reliable, and I think a first rate gun. And I would say that it's as good as anything the FN factory put out. For every bad story you hear of a DSA FAL, I'm sure there's hundreds, maybe even thousands of rifles that do not exhibit the bad things. So they come out right and people are very happy with them. On certain forums, they get bashed. And I will leave that. I've talked about the FAL files, and I think that's a sewer, and there's a lot of toilet bugs in there, and they bash DSA products. But DSA's got good customer service. They produce an excellent product, and they've even gotten government contracts, and they produce what I think is actually cool stuff. I'm not an animal rights person, but I do believe in this anti-poaching thing. I don't think rhinos should be killed off so that people can grind up their horns for an aphrodisiac. I don't believe in that. And so I like the anti-poaching forces that are currently working in Africa. And DSA has supplied them with rifles, parts, and other things. So I would say that, they're legit. They are probably the only FAL manufacturer left in the world. I don't even know if Imbel in Argentina does it, or Brazil, I should say. I don't know if the Argentines still make them, but DSA is probably the only manufacturer. Since there are no more real FAL kits on the market anymore, not in the numbers that there used to be, I know Century Arms does not make FALs anymore, and they used to get bashed too. So, but I've seen a lot of, I own a Century Arms FAL, which I absolutely adore. It's got a Caspian receiver, and it's an excellent gun. I mean, it's an excellent gun. It's got kind of a shorter barrel, 18-inch barrel, and I really like it. It's convenient. Really, really good gun. But to get back to DSA, DSA has done the FAL owners solid with their top cover. Their top cover that's got the rail makes it very, very easy to mount a quality optic on top of an FAL. And an FAL is not necessarily a target grade rifle. It can be reasonably accurate, but it's a battle rifle. But putting an optic on it really can help it and make it a much more versatile rifle. And they produce that excellent top cover that makes that possible. So yeah, DSA is good to go. DSA is good to go. Okay, this next question was asked me by a friend who was pulling my chain. And he said, how can I make my FAL rifle more accurate? And on the serious side, I would say the only advice I'd give him is shoot match grade ammo. Make sure your rifle's clean. Make sure that it's in good working order, that the sights and all that stuff is straight. And then it is what it is. It's a battle rifle. I would not waste time trying to get a better trigger pull. You can do that, but I wouldn't waste time with that. I would just realize it for what it is, and you can enhance the practical accuracy by putting a good sight on it and by shooting good ammo. On the other side of this question, I would say the best way to enhance the accuracy of the rifle is to sell it and go buy a Savage bolt action in 6.5 Creedmoor and put a very expensive, good quality scope on it, and you will have all of the accuracy you want. If you're chasing accuracy, chase it in the appropriate rifle. And that's what I would say, because the FAL is going to be, it's going to have a good level of combat accuracy, but it's never going to be a precision target sniper rifle. It's just not. It's just going to be a good, solid, dependable, and reasonably accurate rifle in a very, very effective caliber. And that's what you have there. Okay, next question. What do you think about using cap and ball revolvers for self-defense? Do these have any kind of a legitimate self-defense use if nothing better is available? And I would say, well, yes, if nothing better is available, a cap and ball revolver is better than nothing. But I think it's foolhardy to think that you can use a cap and ball revolver as a viable defense gun. And here's my reasoning for that. Number one, I can't think of a circumstance where you would have that and not have the opportunity to have something else. If you're too cheap to buy anything but a cap and ball revolver, and they're not inexpensive anymore, I don't know why you would do that. I just don't see why you would use a cap and ball revolver when there's so many more modern alternatives around. And for the record, I shoot cap and ball revolvers. I love them. They are fun to shoot. And they do have ballistic effectiveness. When you look at targets that you've shot with them, you go, hey, wow, I could really see that these things, you know, if you hit the target with them, they're effective. But the problem is they have a lot of doubts. Number one is, You cannot reload them quickly. Even the spare cylinder that some people tout is kind of a foolhardy thing, because if you have a capped spare cylinder, it's so susceptible to having the caps fall off in the pouch or in your pocket or wherever it is. And they never actually did that in the Old West. They never carried those kind of revolver cylinders. They never carried spare revolver cylinders. And we know this because there are no records showing scads of these things being ordered from Colt, or that they were carried or procured by the military, who is the largest user of cap and ball revolvers, especially during the war of Northern aggression, as some people call it, the war between the states, or the Civil War, depending on your view. You know, there just weren't, and we don't have them today. There aren't piles of of these spare cylinders. So that was never used. So they're very slow, impossible to reload under any kind of duress. And in fact, what would happen is they would carry Confederate raiders, who were the big users of these things, would carry sometimes 4 to 6 pistols on them because they would not reload them under fire. So you had that. The other thing you have is, especially the modern reproductions, you know, sometimes the caps can fall off and jam the cylinder. And on the range, this is not a problem. But if you are obviously using this in a self-defense situation, this could be a huge problem. So the reliability is just not as good as a cartridge arm. And even if you get the right kind of nipples and the right kind of caps and all the right kind of stuff, there's still a lot of room and a lot of variables in there that can cause problems. You know, but yes, if the gun discharges, to take the word from the Forged and Fire guy, it will kill. Yes, it can kill, but it's not a very effective. It's kind of like using a single shot rifle. Would you really use one of those for defense? Well, if you discharge it, it will kill its intended target, but it's not the optimum choice. So cap and ball revolvers are a big no-go. Now, the counter argument is, well, there are some jurisdictions where that's all you can get. Well, I would say that if you're in a jurisdiction where all you can get is a cap and ball revolver, and I really think that's more overseas than in the United States, but if you're there, chances are the laws governing self-defense are going to be so restrictive that, frankly, you're going to be, even if it's justifiable and everything else, the way those laws are written and the way that that is all constructed, you're going to be guilty of something very, very bad. So you need a whole nother strategy to avoid violence as opposed to using a firearm under those circumstances and in those places. The laws will not protect you simply because you're using a cap and ball revolver and somehow that's more fair or more cool or more permissible. I think that in those jurisdictions, any firearm used in self-defense will be equally non-permissible. So there you go with using those things for self-defense. Okay, and here's our last question, which is, have you seen the statistic that since people have been allowed to carry pistols in national parks, that over 100 bear attacks have been stopped? And yes, I did see that. My whole deal is that it's intuitively obvious that if you're allowed to defend yourself, you can defend yourself. And a lot of times we think of the bear attack as being the enraged giant grizzly or giant brown bear that you find in Alaska, the one that's got the paw, you know, the size of a giant, of a trash can lid, you know. I mean, we think of these giant, huge creatures, but a lot of times the bear attacks are smaller bears, brown bears and black bears, but they can still do you serious damage. They have claws and they can still harm you and hurt or maim and kill you. So the surprising part of it is how effective some of the smaller caliber guns were. You know, even 22s. You know, were able to dissuade bear attacks. And not surprisingly, the larger calibers, 44 Magnum, 10 millimeter, 45 Colt, that those were, you know, can kill bears. And I think even a large bear, you can kill with one of those. It's not anything you really want to do, but you know, it's definitely can happen. But even a smaller calibers, 9mm and 38, can dissuade a bear attack. You know, a lot of times the bear will, if you don't kill the bear will decide to retreat and go somewhere else. And maybe its nose hurts or its leg hurts because you've shot it there and it doesn't want to continue the fight. So I think that's actually a very, very good thing happening, because people are defending themselves against something that normally would maim or kill them potentially. So that's excellent, but it's also good to know that even a small caliber gun is not inconsequential. It may not be the optimal choice, but it is not inconsequential, and that is the valuable thing to know. You know, I do think that sometimes people overreact, and we always talked about bear attacks. We did a whole series of podcasts talking about bear attacks. It came up every time in some kind of question. But I think that the statistics are bearing out that even a handgun, which is the less optimal choice in a powerful enough caliber, will kill a marauding bear, and even some of the lesser handgun cartridges can dissuade a bear. And that's very important and very, very good. Well, this is it for another episode of Old School Guns. Remember, you can always leave us comments on Podbean. You can always email me at kbmakel@aol.com. And you can just leave a question any time, and we're happy to get to them. We enjoy getting them, and I really like researching and thinking about them, because the ones that come from you are really good. Other questions I run across are, you know, people ask me in conversation and things, and I think that they would be valuable to share here. But you know, go ahead and send us and let us know what you think. And you know, if you want to tell your friends about the podcast, do that too. You know, as we have no sponsors and we are beholden to no one. So anyway, this is it for Old School Guns. And we'll see you next time. Be safe. Do the right things. And, you know, we're all holding together, going to beat this virus. And let's be safe and do all that. And on the other side, we'll see each other out on the shooting range. But this is Old School Guns, out.